Okay, so this is the 9/11 Truth, 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 26th of July 2017. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis facilitating. Craig McKee, secretary. Craig, you want to call the roll?
Sure. I'll read what I have so far. I have Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, David Cole, Dwayne Dietz, James Hufford, Jane Clark, Ken Freeland, Michael Cook, Peter Ketchum, and Wayne Costi, in addition to our speaker, Francis, who's on here obviously also. I noticed that Barry Zwicker was on a few moments ago, and he then disappeared and called me, and I tried to switch over to him, and my phone wouldn't let me, so I'm hoping he's able to get back in. I think he must be having some trouble maybe with that number you were telling us about, Ken.
Yes, so. I'm just wondering if they are having technical difficulties tonight.
Oh, Barry, are you back with us?
Barry's back.
Oh, he's gone again.
He was.
Oh, God, he's gone again. Okay, well, once we start, I can try to figure it out.
Yeah, I think the problem is with that alternative number. I think what it's doing is it's been identified and they're dropping people. Because I bet you Barry's probably using the alternative. Because I remember he had trouble before. And
He did have. Well, maybe hopefully we can figure out how to get him back on. But those are all the names that I've just read. Did I miss anybody? Okay, so I guess that's who we've got so far.
Very good. Okay, so that's who we've got so far. And so then our next item on the agenda is always to approve the minutes from the previous meeting. Any objections to approving the minutes as posted by Craig?
Yeah, this is Wayne.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, I had communicated with Craig already about wanting a link to the PowerPoint that I'd used last time. So that should all be taken care of, but I just wanted to make sure it was as mentioned. Okay.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, that'll be in there for sure.
Okay, so Craig, you'll revise the notes and then send me a revised version for the upload, right?
Yes, I'll definitely. I thought I had sent a revised version of that about two, three weeks ago, but maybe I was thinking of.
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I'll make sure I get it over to you.
Okay, and with that done, then we'll move on to consideration of tonight's agenda. Any amendments for the draft agenda before we adopt it for tonight, Chief? Hearing none, then we'll proceed using the draft agenda. And that brings us to our feature presentation for this evening, which is Francis Richard Collinway. Francis, for those who may not know, is one of the more prominent of the screenwriters.
Can someone call me?
9/11 Truth Movement. And he was called at an early age to the task of screenwriting. He felt called to do that from a very early age and did manage to break into mainstream in the BBC with a hit called Funny How We Don't Talk Anymore. But his claim to fame, as far as we're concerned, is of course, his very somewhat controversial, but very very much very prominent video, the JFK and 9/11, Everything is a Rich Man's Trick. And the title of his talk this evening, which came too late to get into the draft agenda, is, oh, I lost it. Sorry about that.
Critical
you wanted
mass.
To say what it is, Francis? I lost the communication.
Critical mass. Okay.
Critical mass. And there it is, a very enigmatic title for his presentation tonight. So we're going to put him on, that is to say, we're going to put, lecture mode, and put David on mute. And therefore, okay, Francis, the floor is yours. Welcome. We're honored to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I just hope while I'm doing this that you'll be able to arrange the audio so that I can tell if everything's gone off and I'm not, and I'm talking to nobody. At the moment, I can hear a few of you in the background.
The facilitators can communicate with you while everyone else is on mute. So if you have any questions about the audio,
that's
you just have to. Okay.
So one of the facilitators will tell me if I'm being too slow or not making any sense.
No, the floor is yours. You do what you want with it. You've got, we're very glad that you're here to make your presentation. Oh, okay. So just do whatever you feel.
Okay, well, I'll start now. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for having me this evening. As I say, this little, I'll call it a speech, if you like, is going to take about 15 minutes of your time. I hope you all don't mind, but I feel it's important to say what I'm about to say. So this is, as I say, called Critical Mass. Being grown-ups, we all of us know only too well that it's very easy for bodies like the 9/11 Truth Movement to fall into becoming mutual appreciation societies. All over the world, there are humanitarian organizations who mean well, but who never actually achieve anything because over time, dominant figures emerge in every society, principles give way to personalities, and the ideals which start a movement in the first place get forgotten. I would therefore like to use this opportunity to review the 9/11 Truth Movement itself, to hit the pause button, if you will, just for a moment, and look at where the Truth Movement has been, where it is right now, and hopefully where it is going. At the very beginning, the 9/11 issue brought into the public consciousness some truly amazing and distinguished people, like Professor Neil Tarrant. His own professional demolition job on the BBC was truly one of the greatest intellectual achievements of human history. Now, like all the other great 9/11 scientists, Professor Harrod had a right to expect the writers and artists to do their share once it became clear that the official version was simply ludicrous. And I think they have. Dylan Avery, Barbara Honegger, Dave von Kleist, Peter Joseph, and many others have produced laudable films which went a long way to sowing a seed of doubt in the minds of those who have any mind at all. But right here at the start is something which I would like this conference to pause for a moment and think about. Any young person coming fresh to this 9/11 debate can very easily find all of what are now considered to be the prestige documentaries about the 9/11 conspiracy online. All that is except one, and that's my own movie, JFK to 9/11, Everything is a Rich Man's Dream. Any uninitiates who search for the top 9/11 films on Wikipedia will find a long list which, it now seems, the powers that be are happy to let people know about. Please think about that fact while I go through this review. The Truth Movement spawned an alternative media, which the public appeared to feel ambivalent about at first. As the sheer number of hoaxes and false flag operations like Sandy Hook and the London Underground bombings grew and grew, it became clear that the public knew something was not right here. But they didn't all find InfoWars and David Icke convincing. Huge swathes of the Western population simply switched their TVs off, and the broadcaster's own figures prove this. For a while it seemed like there was a vacuum which appears to have been filled, at least to some extent, by my own film. The people who have written to me to express the view that my movie is much more impressive than anything the mainstream media has ever done are legion. And anyone can verify this just by looking through all the public comments pages on YouTube. A consensus seems to have become established that once my movie had gone viral, the alternative media acquired an intellectual respect it did not have previously. And this in turn allowed the most effective alternative broadcasters like Richie Allen, Justin Stellman, and Lee Camp to achieve very considerable influence. The most recent figures suggest YouTube has a billion unique users every day, while the decline in tabloid print journalism and broadcast television is, if anything, increasing. So what does all of this say about the truth movement? What does all of this say about us? I'm getting a lot of background noise from somebody. Is rustling papers and moving chairs? Is a microphone open that shouldn't be? Hello, David?
What's up? Yeah, David is on and Ken is on. Okay, go ahead. Yep. We're all listening to you.
Okay, it's just that there was a lot of background noise of somebody scraping a chair and rustling papers. It was putting me off for a second. So what does all of this say? I'll carry on. What does all of this say about us? I think a fair assessment at this time is that in extremely difficult circumstances, many of us have done a damn good job. Most of the film producers who have come up with significant work have, like myself, had to work for nothing or for very little. And yet together we have completely altered the political perceptions of an entire generation. This has definitely been a great achievement. The big question is whether we can achieve anything more. And the best way to begin to answer that question is first to look at why so many of us are still working for nothing, and also to look at what has been the overriding focus of 9/11 truth societies for over a decade. All truth movement spokesmen maintain to this day that what they seek is a new investigation of 9/11 and all the other false flag attacks. It is my fervent hope that everyone can now see what a naive and childish notion this has been all along. I prefer to think that a lasting effect of my own work is that it has brought to an end an age of innocence and made people realize that there is no such thing as a decent higher authority to which we can turn in times of greatest trouble. There are no decent men in the highest positions of authority. The establishment is corrupt, the marrow of its bones, and we all know that. The time has come to forget about asking the establishment for a new inquiry, because it is monumental folly to ask the establishment for anything. That is simply playing the game in the way they want the game played. Asking their permission for anything simply makes them feel more comfortable, because it makes the public look like children standing before a headmaster. What we should be doing instead is telling them that we are not going to take any notice of them. We do not need their permission to hold a new 9/11 inquiry, because the world's greatest scientists and architects and engineers have already conducted one. Found at the Anglo-American establishment guilty on all counts. We the people already have a case which would win in any bona fide courtroom. Our problem is that the rich own the law and hence have been able to rig the justice system to make sure we can never use it against them. The only way out of this conundrum is that we have to become the law. And the only way to do that is to aim for complete takeover of all world government, however grandiose that might sound. We are never going to solve the great problems of our time by going through conventional political channels. In order to actually solve the issues of phony terrorism, child sexual abuse, rigged elections, fracking, and everything else, we have to attain genuine planet-wide democracy. The question is, how can this be achieved? The first fact that we all have to grasp is that we are involved in a class war, and that just as in any conflict, our side needs major victories. Demographics at this moment appear to be very much on our side, because it is obvious that mainstream media has become a dinosaur facing extinction. Unfortunately, even though most people no longer believe a word of it, the version of reality which comes to them through their television is the only version most people ever hear. If we could shatter that mold and replace the completely spurious mainstream media version of reality with the truth, it would be a colossal step forward. And this, of course, is what I've been trying to do recently with the attempt to crowdfund my work through Indiegogo. Of course, I'm sure most of you will know by now that my crowdfunding campaign was sabotaged, just as the hit ratios for my movie on YouTube have been sabotaged. Google Analytics experts have assured me that the underreporting of hits for my film is in the region of 200 times, which would indicate that at least 500 million people have watched it, and yet barely 50 donated to the campaign to make another one. And many people have written to me to express their condolences and to say that they are certain there has been skullduggery somewhere. Now, we have to ask why my crowdfunding campaign has been the target of such blatant sabotage. It's for the same reason that my movie is not even on the Wikipedia conspiracy films list, and why YouTube have been banning my interviews and underreporting the true number of hits. My work is effective. It has become abundantly clear that the establishment fears my work much more than they fear anyone else's. Since discovering the sabotage, which was undoubtedly done through the dark web in order to leave no trace, I have been racking my brains to think of some way of collecting donations which the oligarchs cannot interfere with. I did consider Western Union, but even there I feel the emails the public would have to send me to give me all the tracking control numbers would simply be blocked out of my email account. I also considered personal checks sent by snail mail, but dismissed this at first because I'm certain the CIA would have no qualms about burning millions of my letters in postal depot fires on the grounds of national security. But then an Austrian fan pointed out something I'd forgotten, that there is such a thing as registered mail, or what we in the UK call recorded delivery. Would the security services dare to interfere in a process whereby a postman has been paid to get a signature on delivery? Well, what do you all think? The postal services survive on nothing other than public trust. If it was known that they had failed to fulfill millions and millions of what are, after all, business contracts to secure delivery of important documents, it would cause a huge scandal, and there would be no way to deny it, because people living in, for instance, New York would have no trouble tracking their donations and finding out if they hadn't been signed for. I mention New York at this point because I honestly believe that that one single city alone could provide the necessary finance if a new initiative called the Everything is a Rich Man's Trick Film Fund was set up in the city center. The New York metropolitan area now has 8.5 million inhabitants. You would think at least 1 million of them have seen my movie. If they all gave $5 each, that would be enough. This is what I've come here tonight to ask you all for. I'm very glad to have the opportunity here now to pay tribute to David Cole, to Roger Borys, and Ken Freeland for making this symposium happen. All three of these men are aware of the difficulty I face in living in the UK. It's a very long way away from America, which is, to speak bluntly, our target market. If an American wanted to post me a check using registered mail, it would become prohibitively expensive. It would cost $7 to send five. Within the United States itself, it only costs, so I've been told, $1. So that is why I believe the 9/11 Truth Movement should set up a separate fund for American donations only and set up another separate branch in Canada while I try to coordinate the UK. Over the last few weeks, David Cole has been making sterling efforts to hook me up with the major players in actors and artists for 9/11 Truth, like Ed Asner. He hopes that through this strategy, I might be brought into contact with figures like Woody Harrelson, Daniel Sanjata, Mark Ruffalo, and Rosie O'Donnell. If the most senior figures in the 9/11 Truth Movement could now help him to achieve this goal, then I feel sure these household names would be able to make the Everything is a Rich Man's Trick Film Fund succeed. I have now established solid contacts in places and as far and wide as Holland, Portugal, Argentina, Germany, France, and even China. They all beg me remorselessly to provide subtitled foreign language translations of my movie, which would go into cinemas in their countries. They have all said that nothing is more politically important at this time, because my film has the power to make everyone on Earth see through the false flag attacks and the phony wars. This is what they assure me of every day. And this is what the oligarchs are so terribly afraid of. This is why they are making such an enormous effort to stop it from happening. Because please ask yourselves this question. If every soldier and every policeman, every housewife and blue-collar worker was able to see that all the terror attacks are phony and that our entire capitalist system is nothing but a con game run by gangsters, could the oligarchs survive? Could they? Now, before I wrap this up, there is something I need to deal with. It's possible that someone in my audience tonight might now be horrified by this little speech. And they might be thinking, my God, what is this man doing? Does he not realize that this is meant to be a forum wherein a group of highly civilized intellectuals can exchange sophisticated ideas? This isn't meant for uncouth matters like fundraising. Well, I would say that this teleconference is or should be about nothing other than making progress by whatever means are necessary. George Orwell once said that no intellectual has any God-given right to shun the dirty work of politics. Those with exceptional ability still have to be prepared to paint slogans on walls and deliver lectures for nothing, as I'm doing right now. Politics is a practical profession in which nothing is ever more important than raising money for the cause. And in a capitalist society, we all know that it all comes down to dollars and cents in the end. Our job is to push and push and push till we create a state of critical mass which will finally explode underneath the rich and blow the oligarchs out of their seats of power. The strategy which I have outlined in this review is, I believe, the best approach possible for increasing that critical mass. Because if my movie makes the billions in profits everyone keeps assuring me it's going to, I shall be more than happy to sponsor further work by those who at present are not being paid. We have all of us discovered to our cost that it is not possible to make a living out of being 100% honest. And really, ladies and gentlemen, what does that tell us about our so-called democratic system? On the internet, I am now known as the man who has woken up America. If Woody Harrelson, who should be showing a special interest in this, or Martin Sheen, or Ed Asner, or any of the others, can put together just one YouTube video in support of my campaign, I might be able to wake up the entire world. And if that could happen, we might be able to displace the oligarchs without a shot being fired. I certainly hope so. Thank you very much for listening. Does anyone have any questions?
Okay, before we go to Q&A, I'd like to ask you, Francis, to elaborate a little bit on what your plans are for your new video, what approach you expect to take there that will further the cause.
My friend, David didn't tell me your name. Could we introduce each other?
Ken Freeland. This is Ken Freeland.
Oh, sorry, Ken. Your voice isn't coming through as strong as everybody else's. I didn't recognize your voice. I beg your pardon.
I've had a tooth extraction today, and gauze at the moment, and it's very difficult.
Oh,
I'm very sorry.
So what is it specifically you need to know, Ken?
Well, your plans for your new video, could you elaborate a bit on what that's going to involve? I mean, what are you going to do with that would invite listeners to support your work? Where are you going to go with it?
I want to be very careful in answering this, Ken, mm-hmm. because something I'm desperate not to do is to give away to the powers that be what the content of the film will be. I'm not even able at this moment in time to tell anyone the title. That's how much I want to keep my cards close to my chest at this moment in time, and that's why I've been calling it that. I've been giving it the name so far, JFK to 9/11 Part 2, just so that people could get some frame of reference on it. I think that the best thing to say about this is that First of all, it is a completely original script in exactly the same way as the first one was a completely original script. It's nothing at all like the first one. But I will be prepared to say that ever since my movie came out and made such an impact, mm-hmm. people have been writing to me saying that there are some things that I should have gone into a great deal more. I will say that in the next film, I intend to do that. Is that okay? Is that enough?
That's fine. We're going to go into question and answer mode now, but before we do, I just want to make my own comment that in addition to things that you may not have explored that you wish to explore, I personally wish you hadn't, if I recall the film correctly, hadn't gone into some of the metaphysical things that you went into, because I think that detracts from the overall...
Metaphysical in what sense?
Well, I
you're talking about the devil bit.
Go ahead. Yes. It's not a question of having a metaphysical perspective, but it's a question of anything that those holding a particular metaphysical point of view, perhaps Christian or whatever, might find problematic.
Objectionable.
Objectionable, and therefore pull away from the larger impact of your film had you not entered into those areas. But that's just my own thinking. So I'm going to now put this into question and answer mode, and folks will queue up automatically by pressing star 6 once we get there, and then David will respond to you in turn. One moment, please.
Okay.
Okay. So again, star 6 if you wish to be in the queue to ask a question or make a comment. Star 6 will get you into the queue. Okay, first in the queue is Jane Clark. Jane, go ahead.
Yes, I noticed that on the Indigo that you had for the movie, Everything is a Rich Man's Trick, Part 2, it's a closed campaign. So how do we contribute if it's closed?
You still there, Jane?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there was an automatic lady's voice that said unmuted. I think I know what question you're asking. This new campaign will just be open-ended. That's my idea, because there's been a lot of people who've contacted me. To my great surprise, a lot of people have contacted me since the 30-day time limit of Indiegogo ended. The reason that I made the campaign a 30-day thing was that when I first started, we were looking at Kickstarter, and it said on the Kickstarter blurb that if a campaign is going to work, that we've always found in the past, it's going to work in 30 days. And I could have believed that. If people are interested, they're interested. If they're not, they're not. But with my campaign and my work being a target for disruption by the powers that be, that makes things a lot more complex. So I think that this new campaign, which I'm hoping David Cole will be able to set up in New York, and also that his friend Roger Borries will be able to set up in San Francisco, because he's not very far from Oakland. In fact, I think he's right next to it. I'm hoping that they'll be able to do that and just set up anything, something, some kind of office where there'll always be someone to sign for, whatever comes in. One of the major reasons for that, if I can slip this in, because I think I've bored David Cole with this before, but it's very important, because when my film was first released, and this is only weeks, in fact, I'm not even sure if it was 2 weeks into being released, it made such an impact in the Oakland area of San Francisco that they started having public meetings where they decided to show my movie, and they were charging $5, or at least they were saying that a donation of $5 would be expected for anybody who came along to see it. Well, I didn't mind that because, you know, I wanted my movie to have an impact. But what I'm hoping is that those people who've seen it will now be prepared to donate $5 again so that, you know, I can make another movie. The big problem, you see, Jane, up till now is that, you know, it's obvious that there is a huge public out there that supports the truth movement. There's a huge amount of interest in this. I'm certain that there are millions and millions of people who would back me if they could get to hear about it and it was laid out before them, you know, what we need the money for. Our problem is that, you know, the Illuminati are doing everything they can, including, you know, infiltrating organizations like Occupy Oakland and like Occupy Wall Street. They're putting their spies into these places. And it's desperately difficult to coordinate the interest into making donations appear. That's a desperately difficult job. And it's even more desperately difficult for me because I'm stuck here 5,000 miles away in the UK. And also, I'm not an American. You people know your country much better than I do. You know how to reach out to Americans better than I do and sell, you know, my ideas and my work to them better than I do. So that's why I'm hoping that's what will come out of this particular conference will be, an initiative that recognizes the problems that we're having with the internet and trying to use the internet against the oligarchs, because they're not going to let us do that. They're not going to let us do that. And once that's recognized, and I think it has to be recognized that we've got to use old-fashioned methods to bring in donations if it's ever going to work. So I hope I'm not blabbering too much now, but that, has that answered the question okay?
Yeah, it does, but there is not a portal to give you money, right?
How do you mean, Jay?
Well, I mean, Indigo is closed. Is there another portal?
At the moment, yes. I mean, the Indiegogo campaign is over, and I don't think there's any point in trying to reawaken it again or try Kickstarter or anything else online, because it's obvious that the Illuminati are not going to let me be helped in any way through the internet. They're going to scuttle that. They're going to sabotage it every time. So, no, at the moment, there's nothing open whereby anybody could send anything to me, no.
Okay, but hopefully that'll be resolved in the future.
I hope so. I hope so,
okay. And I don't want to take up all the time here, but the issue of Luciferianism, I think, is very pertinent to what's going on right now, as
Absolutely.
We've seen in the Dutch bankers' videos.
Yes,
recently.
Yes.
So I don't think that, and I know there's Satan churches in Texas. I mean, you know, there are. So that is, so we've got satanic stuff where the Supreme Court justice was died, Scalia. We've got statues going up in different places that are satanic. So I think that's totally relevant to what's going on nowadays. That's all I have.
Well, Jane, thank you. No, if you don't mind, I'd like to make a point there, because I wrote to the gentleman, it's pronounced Godert Volta, who is the producer at DVM-TV that have been making the Ronald Bernard videos.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally got around to watching my movie. It took about 3 weeks, but he finally got around to watching it a few days ago and wrote back, basically just saying, wow, amazing, incredible, what a great job, da-da-da-da-da. And most importantly, he said that, isn't it wonderful that, even this is like 2 years later, that Ronald has confirmed everything in your movie. and is true. And if you don't mind, everybody, I'd like to make that point loud and clear, that this man has, you know, confirmed that everything I've said is accurate, simply by being a man who's, you know, seen the oligarchs from the inside and seen the Illuminati circle from the inside. So it's very, very important to me, that very important indeed. So thank you for bringing that up, Jane. Thank you very much.
Okay, next is from Michael Cook.
Hi there, am I on?
Hello, Michael. Yes, I can hear you. Nice to meet you.
You can't see me, or maybe you can. I don't know.
Well.
thank you for being on. This
You're
is
welcome.
So great. And I think I may be able to help you out. I volunteer when I can. I mean, I work. Do you know about me, first of all?
No one's told me about you. Michael Cook, is it, Michael?
No one's mentioned
you so far. No, where do you fit in?
Well, I don't want to give my life story or anything, but I've been in this for a long time, since, you know, really before 9/11 happened. I was wakened by Michael Parenti. I don't know, have you ever heard of Michael Parenti?
I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and what you said about class war is just spot on, and he kind of woke me up. I foreshadowed the truth movement a little bit by distributing his lectures on cassette tapes. But he's a political scientist from Yale.
I recognize
Home of Skull and Bones. Yeah, and he's got a lot of really good lectures and books out there. He puts things in, and he's a very good, clear thinker and incredibly knowledgeable and stuff. Anyway, I've been volunteering with architects and engineers since 2008, and actually the translation team was my idea. I suggested that we form a translation team and have them translate the AE material into other languages, subtitles, and all that. And I'm in good, close contact with the two leaders of that team. So I will float the idea of translating your movie, which is excellent,
Michael, I was going to say, I should have mentioned before, that the actual translators, that's no problem at all. I've got so many people. In fact, the great thing about it is that since from the very beginning, I've had Germans in particular, because they're desperate to get my movie into Germany, to teach the Germans their true history for the first time, you know what I mean? I've got a lineup of Germans who are begging me, saying, "Look, I'll work for nothing. You don't have to pay me a penny. I want to be the man who is going to translate your movie into German." Now, the man who I've chosen is a very, very, very brilliant physician and a wonderful man and a very brave man, because you know he could get into a lot of trouble. But the actual translators themselves are lined up and ready to work. I've got a Dutch translator, a Spanish translator, a German translator, a French translator. That's not the problem, Michael. The problem is going to be, right down the line, finance. Even if I can get my movie translated into every language on the globe, there's still going to be the problem of how do I get the damn thing into independent cinemas all over the world. Mm-hmm. Now, I actually think that in your country, I actually think that in both America and Canada, that might not be too difficult, because there are lots of them, and Americans are so, you know, proud of you know, the freedom to express themselves, freedom to watch anything they want, that I think that they would very, very quickly kick up a fuss if it was becoming obvious that my movie was now a cinema movie and they weren't being allowed to see it, you know, in America. I could see a public standoff where, you know, the police trying to stop my movie being shown in an independent cinema, and people brought their guns to, you know, to get the police away or something. I could see that happening. I really could, and it would be great publicity. I just hope that, you know, if it ever does happen, that no one gets shot or hurt. But the thing is that I can see far, far greater difficulties in places like India and in places like China. You know, the oligarchs have got this whole world under their little finger, and if they want to disrupt the showing of my film, particularly in the third world, I think it's going to be very easy for them. Creating a network, a distribution network all over the world that's going to take my movie to all corners of the globe. That, my friend, is, again, you know, money, that's why we need to have an open-ended campaign. And even if right now, I mean, if this started tomorrow and there was $20 million there straight away and somebody said, well, you know, you said you only needed three. Yeah, but how much money am I going to need to create an international distribution network all over the world that will be able to get around the oligarchs?
We've been doing it at Architects and Engineers, you know, mostly through the internet. You're spot on about, you know, the internet and all the shenanigans that go on and about going old-fashioned ways to get money to you. I mean, a P.O. box. People can send you checks, you know. There's ways around the system. It can't be internet only. It's you've got to be in the street. My local group here, we've done Fourth of July parades.
Michael. Yes. We don't want this to become just a two-party conversation here.
Right. I don't want to do that either. Just trying to get through the little list of stuff I made.
Anything else that you have that you needed to ask him, or can we go on to another?
Do you have an email? Can you give us your email and we can converse with you? We don't have to take up everybody's time.
Right.
I do have an email. David Coles got it. You want me to give it right now?
Or David could put it out, or if he already did,
The thing is, I don't know if this is going to go out on YouTube, so I don't know if it's a good idea to give my.
It doesn't go out on YouTube, Francis, but it does get archived, so it is publicly available to all of our members and to anybody else that is interested. But generally, it's usually just the members that would be accessing it.
Well, look. If Michael Cook wants to take it now, I don't mind at all. I mean, what the hell? I get annoyed at other people making.
I can give you mine. I don't mind, you know, putting mine out there. You can contact me. That's fine. M. Cook, M-C-O-O-K at AE911truth.org.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, lovely. I'll no problem, Michael. You know, we'll write to each other and take it from there.
Hey, thank you. You can always block people, you know, right? Yeah. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Okay, I don't see anyone else in the queue, so I'd like to make a couple of personal comments here. First of all, on your funding issue, Francis, I do think your idea.
What's that?
somebody's making a drink and should really star six if they can.
I just muted him. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl.
So, on your funding issue, I do think your idea of getting registered checks by registered mail is quite appropriate, and I do think it would be very difficult for that particular vehicle to be in any way abrogated by the powers that be without creating a serious enough contradiction that it would cause them more problems than it's worth to do so. So I think as a last resort, I'm sure that that's a very, very useful approach. But I do hope with Jane that you will get something else going on the internet. And I should say that I just recently was given some information by a new entrepreneur or whatever you call him who's starting a new type of independent online crowdsourcing approach.
Yeah.
So I'll share that with you anon, okay? And you can take a look at that and see if you think it might be helpful. And with respect to the metaphysical thing, again, I don't disagree with Jane that there's validity to it. I'm just questioning whether or not including it is useful to reach a wider audience, or whether it tends to put some people off that might otherwise be attracted. And I think it's kind of in the way in which you approached it rather than the fact that you approached it that, I mean, the cartoonish business and all that just seemed to me a bit...
Cartoonish?
If I'm not mistaken, you used, like, devil cartoons... It just seemed like it was, I don't know how to explain it, but it just seemed like it was making either too light or too serious at the same time kind of thing. I don't know. I was just put off a little bit by that, but myself. But just wondering about, you know, his general feel for the audience.
No, I'll take it on board, my friend. I'm always, you know, responsive to, you know, all analysis and criticism. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say to people, whatever you think, just tell me what you really think. I mean, the very first gentleman who we showed it to, mm-hmm. I didn't know beforehand, was I wouldn't exactly call him a religious nut, but it was interesting, bearing in mind that he's actually the Lord Mayor of my city, and it was very strange when we got to that point where I felt there was no way better of explaining just exactly what the situation is, because, you know, even though I'm not a religious man myself at all, and I would be the first to say to people that the concept of the devil himself is a rich man's trick. That, you know, everybody has got their own idea of what the devil is, and that is what we're fighting. And that was why I used that image. Mm-hmm. But he was frightened by that image. It really shook him, and he was saying, "Oh, you know, you should take that out." So I was kind of amazed at that reaction from a grown man in his 50s. Okay. So
At the last comment. Oh, gosh, I just lost my train of thought there. I think it's all the painkillers. Hang on a second.
That's all right.
Can I also would like to ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead, Cheryl. Yeah, please.
Okay. Yeah, Francis,
Cheryl, I'm glad you're going to ask a question. You know why? I really love your voice. I heard your voice on the other recordings, and you remind me of somebody, and I'm trying to think who it is. It's annoying me. Oh, I know who you remind me of.
Who's that?
You remind me... in the way, it's not so much your voice, it's in the way that you speak of that beautiful lady who sang in The Mamas and the Papas. What was her name? Michelle?
Oh, really?
Michelle.
Michelle.
Oh, what was her name?
Michelle
Phillips. Yeah, you remind me. Yeah, something about your voice brings her face to mind. Is that what you look like?
I don't think so, but I don't know. Well, thank you. What I want to say is thank you for coming on, and I really appreciated you kind of challenge us to think about what we're doing and where we're going, and I like that. And I don't know how Indiegogo works so much, but I wanted to ask you, have you ever thought of like using PayPal or something like that, like setting up a website?
This is what David suggested, and other people have too. The trouble is, Cheryl, that as I've tried to make clear, that, you see, a lot of people don't know that the internet in the first place was invented and set up to be part of the military machine.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of the internet in its first conception was that it was going to coordinate armies and air forces and navies better than they'd ever been coordinated before. It was going to mean instant. You see, have you ever seen Sink the Bismarck, the movie?
No.
You ever seen that movie, Cheryl?
No,
well,
no.
In that movie, they do retail something that was true, which was that when the aircraft, the torpedo bombers that were launched from the aircraft carrier Victorious, set out in pursuit of the Bismarck on the second day of the battle, they wound up attacking HMS Sheffield, their own ship. And that was just purely and simply because somebody made a boo-boo and said, you know, that HMS Sheffield was much farther north than she actually was. And they almost sank their own ship. The whole idea of the internet was that just couldn't happen anymore, because there was going to be what we've got here right now, instantaneous, you know, messaging that is so clear, you know, you're never going to be able to get it wrong. And that was what it was originally set up for. Now, the military mind is the military mind. Whenever they create anything, they always create it with one eye on making sure that it can never be fired back at them, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. They always try to make sure. And when I've asked people about the dark web, because I'm not an IT man, but the man who I know who is the IT expert, he said the way you should think about it It is basically just, you know, the internet itself can be thought of as a train track that goes through a dark tunnel, and you can't see where you're going as you're going there. You just get whatever message to the end. And he said that when they set it up, all they did was to put another layer, another track, you know, in a subterranean fashion, below the internet highway. And they've put it in a way that means that they can reach through a trapdoor into the internet level anytime they want and steal anything out of it and mess it up if they want to. And they can do it without being seen because it's kind of like all in the dark. Well, you see, they're going to do that. They're going to do that.
Well, here's what I'm thinking is you could put this under somebody else's name, and then I don't know how would you, and use, you know, PayPal is big and probably connected to all the CIA or whatever, but there are other sites like PayPal that are smaller and less known, and I wondered if you could get away with it in using one of them.
Well, you know, Cheryl, if you can, honestly, and I say this to all of you who are listening, anybody who's got any great ideas, I'm not going to resist them. If you can think, because, you know, it's a perfectly fair point that youngsters, particularly nowadays, have become so lazy because of laptops that if they've got to do anything more than just click a mouse, it's like too much trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a point that's been made over and over again. So, you know, I'm not resistant to it. It's just that what I've found in real life is that, I mean, I have been emailing every rock star, every film producer, every film director, everybody who's got mega money. I've tried to get in touch with Woody Harrelson over and over and over and over again because of the involvement of his father in the assassination. I hoped that he would, you know, morally want to do something about that. And he, you know, presents himself online as being this stalwart of humanitarian values, and he wants to change the world, and he wants to change the planet. Well, if that's the case, why hasn't he got in touch with me? You know, my movie is the biggest thing, you know, by a mile in the conspiracy films thing. I mean, it's you know, thousands of times more popular even than Dylan Avery's picture. It, you know, you would think that out of all of them, Rosie O'Donnell, Charlie Sheen, all of them, that one of them would have wanted to get in touch with me. And yet we still find that if someone's got money, they won't support the truth movement with their money. Now, I'm finding that more and more and more suspicious as time goes on. David Cole and I have discussed whether or not, you know, there are secret agents and, you know, dubious people who've been planted inside the truth movement, and I'm sure that there are some. It's a very difficult issue because I don't want to accuse anybody's good faith. I think in most cases, it's purely and simply that my emails just never reach these people, that their email accounts are being blocked, and that my messages are just not getting to them. That's what I think is happening most of the time. And that's why I'm hoping that people on your side of the Atlantic can do something to break through this wall, because I do think it would only take just one of those household names who I've mentioned to support me publicly and support my movie publicly, to, you know, bring in enough finance to get, you know, part one internationally distributed and you know, dubbed into foreign languages, and to get part two made as well. If any of the people who I've mentioned could support it, then, you know, if you could all get together, as I've said, and you know, somehow, I mean, David weeks ago told me that he was trying to get through to Ed Asner to get, you know, my movie screened to everyone and actors and artists, you know, for 9/11 Truth. And ever since he's tried, he's been frustrated because he says they're all dragging their feet. Well, why are they all dragging their feet? Why should they all be dragging their feet for something that the public agrees is the most important movie of all politically at this moment in time? You know, it's very frustrating for David. It's very frustrating for me, and you know, that's why, you know, I've been racking my brains to think of a way around this, you know, Illuminati control. But believe me, Cheryl, anybody who has a great idea for bringing money in, I'm not going to resist it.
Yeah, I was thinking, and I don't know much about this, so I don't know if this would work. But have you thought about Bitcoin? Because I don't think the government.
Do you know, somebody did suggest Bitcoin. But again, that's another thing that goes over the internet. So that's another thing that I think the Illuminati can control.
Mm-hmm.
It's anything that goes over the internet superhighway is, I think, going to be manhandled by the dark web to stop me from getting where I want to be. And you know, I just do not see a way around it. There is a habit in modern life now, and I hope you know that nobody who is listening to me now will get offended by this. Please just try to think of this philosophically. But there is a habit in modern life, I think now, which says that all you need for anything, for, you know, all you need to improve your life is a better website. I just don't think life is like that. You know, the websites can be incredibly useful things. They can be wonderful tools for, you know, certain things. But when you've got the, you know, these Luciferians and their dark webs trying to stab you in the back in the dark, you know, a better website isn't necessarily, you know, a panacea for all ills, I'm afraid. You know, I don't think that we're going to be able to raise the cash that I need unless we just go back to, you know, to old-fashioned methods. And you know, I've just got to cross my fingers and hope that I'm right and hope that it works, you see. I mean, if you think that Western Union within the United States itself might work, then by all means, try it. But it's just, I'm concerned, you see, that it always means that whoever's sending you the money has got to send you an email with the tracking number. And if that's the case, then they can just block the email. You know, if David Cole was you know, collecting it in Manhattan, you know, if he set up something there and, you know, they would just block the emails out of his account, he would never know what was coming in. So it's, you know, you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall with this. It's incredibly frustrating.
Does that complete it for you, Cheryl?
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
You're very
okay.
Welcome, Cheryl.
So, recovering my thoughts here, on a positive note, Francis, I want to say how much I appreciated your emphasis on the class struggle, and I hope that in your follow-up you do emphasize that particular theme. On a critical note, with respect to how films in America go through the mainstream theaters, I think you may have somewhat of a misconception. But there, it depends in the first place on whether or not some distributor feels it has the production values and the potential revenue generation to be distributed in the first place, at which point it's a done deal. Otherwise, how would it be getting into the mainstream theaters in the first place? You see, that's sort of the sine qua non of a film that gets into the mainstream theaters for the most part.
I don't disagree with you, Ken, but this is why I think that the only way that my movie will, you know, get seen by American audiences who haven't looked at YouTube, basically the older generation, is that it would be necessary for someone, perhaps yourself, to target all of the independent theaters who are not tied directly to any of the, you know, the big chains, the Walt Disney's.
There are very few that meet that description. Very few.
I'm aware of that, tied up
with major distribution networks.
Yeah, but there are some, though. I checked this on the internet. There's some still do exist, and that's how I think.
When you're talking about mainstream, then you're talking about the alternative or the independent theaters that.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. We're never going to get
into Paramount theaters, you know. Never.
Okay. I misunderstood your point, Ken. That's all.
No.
Okay. So there's no one else in the queue. So I guess what we'll do at this point is thank Francis for spending so much time very late time for him. It's probably going on 2 a.m. over there.
2:07.
2:07. Yes. So. a sacrifice on his part, but we appreciate it because the insight into what he's up to and what he needs is important for our movement. So thank you, Francis. We appreciate it very much.
You're all very welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you all. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun for me. I really have enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Good night.
Night.
Bye.
Good night, David.
Night.
Good night.
Okay. So that then brings us to our second agenda item, which is the Cotter payout. The propaganda drives ugly reaction to Cotter payout. With Craig McKee. Craig, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. I thought I would start before sort of just giving a bit of background to this story. I would like to ask people on the call, how many of you have heard of Omar Khadr? And I mean beyond just having read the draft agenda. But how many of you know, have any idea sort of who he is and what happened to him?
Well, hold on, Clay. We're going to have to take it out of...
I should have warned you about that, yeah.
Yeah, let's end the question and answer session. Okay, now you can ask your question.
Okay. I forgot about the technical thing to overcome there. Yeah, I just, I guess everybody heard me, right? So I don't have to repeat the question. I just have to ask people to let me know if you have any idea who Khadr is and what happened to him.
Yeah, I can say, Craig, this is Cheryl. I only heard about her from you. I didn't hear it anywhere else. So.
Okay.
Well, I heard
anybody
about,
else?
I heard about it. I heard about it from Kevin Barrett on a recent show. He mentioned Khadr and the ongoing issue.
Okay.
Yeah, Wayne here. I'm not familiar with it at all. So.
Okay. Anybody else who is? Or?
This is Dwayne. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I have not heard of it other than from you, of him.
Okay.
This
so,
is Jane.
This is Mike Cook.
Yeah, Jane and Mike?
Never heard of him.
Okay. Mike, same for you?
I think I heard something on mainstream media, like in passing, and then never again.
Right.
Not him from other sources.
So I, am I correct in saying that really nobody sort of really followed the story and knows it? I'll assume that unless someone interrupts me. So here's the basic thing. I think this is a very great interest both to people north and south of the border because it has both Canadian and American components to it. Khadr was he's a Canadian citizen born in Toronto. He is now 31 years old, but in 2002, he had been brought by his father to Afghanistan, and his father was alleged to have been involved with Al-Qaeda, and that's a whole other kind of story, I guess, the extent to which that may or may not have been true, but I don't think it's really central to what the story is. So he was... in Afghanistan, in a compound that, again, was alleged to be an Al-Qaeda compound, and there was a firefight that took place. The American forces, and this, of course, is several months after the invasion of Afghanistan began, and so they attempted to enter this compound, and they were denied entry, and a firefight ensued, which... once shots were being fired from inside the compound, then the American forces pummeled it with enormous firepower and many hundreds of pounds of bombs. And they believed everybody inside would be dead at that point. But a grenade was lobbed from the other side of a wall, which ended up killing an American serviceman causing another to lose sight in one of his eyes. And Cotter was in this compound. His father was not there. His father sort of left him there, and he was 15 at the time. So he was gravely wounded in the assault, and because he was alleged to be the only person alive, still alive in the compound, that he must have been the one that threw this grenade that killed the American servicemen. So now it later came out that there was a second person alive inside who was basically executed by one of the soldiers. And Cotter himself was shot twice in the back as he lay or sort of half sat up after being wounded. So basically Cotter was taken to Guantanamo Bay, and to this day he's the only child who has ever been incarcerated there. He was tortured there and basically deprived of due process for a very long time. He didn't even have the beginnings of a trial for 8 years. In fact, he didn't even have access to a lawyer for the first 2 years that he was there. And he was visited by Canadian officials who documents later showed that they knew full well that Cotter was being abused and tortured, and they reported to the Canadian public that he was being, and to the government officials in Ottawa, that he was being well treated. So basically, and there have been three different Supreme Court decisions on the Cotter case that have all gone against the government. They've basically spent $5 million already just fighting this case. And I'm just kind of looking for the example here. Yeah, so in 2008, it ruled that Canadian officials had acted illegally by sharing intelligence information about Cotter with U.S. captors. So what happened there was that they questioned him, and you can see there's video of this where he's basically pleading with them to get him out of there. And without informing him that this is what they were going to do, they then shared that information with the U.S. officials. So what the latest development in all of this, just to jump ahead for a moment so that you kind of know why this is coming up now, is that Cotter ended up pleaded guilty. He did a plea deal where he obviously had to stipulate to having thrown the grenade that killed Sergeant Christopher Speer. With that plea deal, it was an 8-year sentence that he would have to serve, and only one more year of that would be in Guantanamo Bay and the rest of it in Canada. He is now out on bail and is living in Edmonton. But he actually filed a lawsuit while he was still incarcerated, or his lawyers did for him, in 2004 for $20 million for the abuse of his rights by the Canadian government. I'm not quite sure why they don't sue the American government, but I guess that's another question. But they had to sort of refile this lawsuit later on for reasons that are, I guess, legal in nature. They had to rewrite it and refile it. So the Canadian government just earlier this month, or late last month, agreed to a settlement with Cotter for $10.5 million, which is Canadian, which is a little less American. That's $8.4 million American. So he received this settlement of his lawsuit and an apology from the Canadian government. Yeah, so that is where it stands right now. The widow of Sergeant Speer won a wrongful death suit while Cotter was in prison for $134 million, but neither Cotter nor his lawyers were even informed that the suit was going on. So I'm not even sure how legally that even can happen, but that somebody can be sued without being told they're being sued. But in any case, what just happened in the last couple of weeks was that the widow of Sergeant Speer tried to get Cotter's the payment frozen to prevent, so that, and I guess with the goal in mind of recouping that money towards the $134 million, but that apparently is not very likely to happen. And actually, I'll mention, too, that Barry Zwicker, who unfortunately had problems with signing on to the call tonight, pointed out there's an article just the other day that came out whereby the medic that actually worked on Cotter sort of told his story, where he said that he wondered whether he even should try to save the life of this person, because a lot of the service people who were there that day were very angry because they had lost one of their men. And he said that he even had a thought for a moment that they should toss him out of the helicopter, but he didn't do that, and he worked very hard to keep him alive. And he kind of tells the story now because he expressed how glad he is that he did that, and that he knew that was the right thing to do. So there's a really good article about that. I had hoped by the time of this call that I would have my own article up and posted on my blog, but that didn't happen. So perhaps that'll be up in the next week or so, and I can have all these links will be in there. But you know, there are so many things to this. I mean, the reason that I sort of made the reference in the that you see in the agenda there to the idea of propaganda is that the reaction from people that I encountered on Facebook and even in the media, I mean, there was a poll done that said that 71% of Canadians are opposed to this payout. And I've argued with many of those people on Facebook because I guess this case, it more than most of the stories that we run across, I guess, in the stuff that we do, this made me just so angry. The injustice of this made me so angry. The idea that not only could the American military torture a child and detain the child without due process for literally years, but that the Canadian government could not only not do anything about it, but once Prime Minister Stephen Harper got involved, they went from not doing anything to help to enthusiastically and aggressively opposing everything to do with Cotter. I mean, they wanted him tried as a hardened terrorist. And so the reason that the government's having to pay this $10.5 million out is, I think, entirely thanks to Prime Minister Harper. And that's – so the taxpayers are very angry. They think, how could you give this all this money to this terrorist? But, of course, they're ignoring – first of all, they're ignoring the fact that there is no evidence against Cotter that he threw any grenade of any kind. In fact, he was under rubble when they found him, and the idea that he could be buried somehow after the grenade—it's not possible, because that's all the damage had been done. The attack had finished at that point. So not only is he not, there's no proof of his guilt, but all they basically got is this plea deal, and the plea deal—I mean, literally. Cotter believed that if he didn't agree to this deal, so that at least he'd be shipped back to Canada, that he could literally spend the rest of his life in Guantanamo Bay. And his lawyer even said that even with the plea deal, without the plea deal, there was no guarantee that they wouldn't just keep him indefinitely, regardless of what any trial said. So there's really no evidence against him except this plea deal. So, of course, all the media are reporting, you know, convicted terrorist, you know, Omar Cotter. But, of course, he's, first of all, he was a child at the time, which doesn't seem to bother too many people. They don't seem to be too concerned about that. They seem to be more concerned about their tax dollars going to this. I mean, so many people that I encountered all they thought about was the money, and they were saying, oh, we could do so much more with that money. We could give it to veterans who are mistreated and all this, which is entirely kind of apples and oranges. So anyway, it's an outrageous story, and it's a very, I think it's a really sad story. The current situation is that he's in school, and he's been living with his lawyer for a number of years, and I think he's only recently moved out into his own apartment, but that shows how much that his own lawyer believed in him, that he basically invited him to stay in his home with him. So anyway, that's a quick sort of overview, and I'm sure there's all kinds of important details that I haven't even come close to touching on. I'll mention one more thing. The prosecution actually withheld evidence that showed that there was a second person still alive in the compound. And they were building their case on the fact that there was only, that Cotter was the only person in the compound who was still alive. But then a Pentagon report came to light, and I'm just going to read a quick quote for it, from it. And it's talking about, it doesn't identify the soldier that went in and shot Cotter in the back, or the other one, the one that they were covering up. But here's the quote. He says, he heard moaning coming from the back of the compound. The dust rose up from the ground and began to clear. He then saw a man facing him lying on his right side. And this was not Cotter. This was the other one. And the man had an AK-47 on the ground beside him, and the man was moving. So the soldier fired one round, striking the man in the head, and the movement ceased. And then when the dust arose, he saw a second man, which was Cotter, sitting up facing away from him, leaning against the brush. This man, so the soldier then fired two rounds into this person's back. So that was kept from the defense. So that's just, I just want to throw that in there. So I don't know if I've given enough to make this whole story clear or not. There's so much more to it, obviously, than what I've had a chance to say so far. But having no concept of how long I've been talking, perhaps it might be good to, at this point, to open it up for questions, and then I'm sure all other things will pop into my head as we go.
Okay, so if you want to ask a question or make a comment, star 6, and that will put you in the queue. And Craig, as we're waiting for people to line up, I'd like to ask you, how can you possibly sue somebody for wrongful death in a war? What is the rationalization there?
Well, that's a good point, and that's one of the craziest things about this whole story. In fact, they actually created a new crime that no one had ever been charged with before. And not only did they create this new crime, but they retroactively charged Cotter with it.
Ooh.
They invented a new crime called murder by an unlawful alien enemy combatant. Again, forget about the fact that it's a child.
What makes him unlawful?
Maybe you should ask them, but unlawful, good question. I mean, he was not an Afghan. He was not Afghani. I don't know if that's what they mean by it. That's a good question. I'm not sure why that would, but I mean, the fact that they're calling it murder means that they're not considering him to be a military part of the conflict.
They're not considering him a combatant.
Well, I know. There's the contradiction, right? He's a non-combatant combatant. Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. It's not only insane that, I mean, the American forces were acting militarily against this compound. They were also invaders of that country. Mm-hmm. So how it's legal to, I mean, they shot Cotter in the back twice. That's legal. a wounded man, shoot him in the back. That's apparently okay.
Yeah.
And killing, executing the other guy.
Look at either he's a combatant or he's not. If he's a non-combatant, then shooting him in the back is a crime. Okay, it's a war crime. And if he's
right.
not, if he is a combatant, then he's not a non-combatant. Okay, I mean, they can't have it both ways.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely agree. And just, I mean, just the fact that they would make up a new, you know, a new name
yeah.
for the crime after the fact, kind of tells you what you need to know about that.
Amen. Okay. So Michael Cook has a question. Let's go to Michael. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey there.
Hey.
Good to hear you, Craig. Just to clarify, the unlawful enemy combatant actually rose its ugly head here in the U.S. Quite some time ago. It was part of the Military Commissions Act or the Patriot Act, one of those post 9/11 legal extravaganzas that they did, and it was meant to apply to Americans. Like, yeah, we can declare you an unlawful enemy combatant because of whatever, and that's where that came from. This is a horrific story, and I'm sure it's only a very small part of everything that goes on that we never hear about. And now, thank you for covering it. I look forward to reading your article. This is a little difficult, but you guys all know what side I'm on and everything here. But playing devil's advocate a little bit, I don't know if you've ever read John Steinbeck, like Grapes of Wrath and so on, you know, the striking workers,
yeah.
Is a 15-year-old, you know, and you shot him. Yeah, well, he had a .30-06, you know. It was a 15-year-old
uh-huh.
with a .30-06. And I started shooting when I was 12 years old, unsupervised, you know, without adult. I'm from the gun culture. I'm from the country. I was shooting as a small child with close guidance and coverage. This child soldier thing is horrific. Soldiers in battle, you know, do things that nobody would normally do. And we got to stop the war machine. You know, that's what it comes down to, is you got to avoid these
okay.
situations.
Did you have a
from arriving.
Did you have a question or a comment for Craig on his presentation?
I just look forward to reading the article. I'm really glad you're on the story.
Yeah. Sounds
well,
good.
Thanks,
okay.
Mike. I'll make a quick comment on that, Ken. I think there is, and there may be somebody on the call knows is better able to quote this than I am, but there. I mean, the United Nations has rules that apply to child soldiers. So it's not that somebody's 15 couldn't handle a gun, but it's whether they have, you know, in the case of Cotter, he didn't even want to be there. It wasn't that he went there. His father brought him there. His father
right.
brought him there, and he wasn't even there. He wasn't in any kind of combat, post. He was brought in there as a translator because he speaks four languages. So he was in this compound, not in a military capacity. So, and
right.
plus the fact that there's absolutely no proof that he actually did anything. So I think when you put those two things together, you've got a pretty grave injustice, I think.
Well, I think the settlement speaks to that, you know, and that is certainly a step forward. You know,
yeah.
as horrific and awful as this is, it's a major milestone that they've won.
You know, I agree with that, and here's the kind of the reason for why I find it really outrageous, the public reaction to be outrageous, is that people don't seem to be concerned about whether a child should be charged in that kind of a situation, or whether someone's rights should be respected, or whether it's okay to just deny them due process. So many people up here just seem to think, oh, that's too much money. And they don't seem to think beyond that. So that's pretty
good. Oh, yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay, so Wayne is next. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, Craig, thanks. It's a very interesting story. The thing that comes to mind, and I'm not sure if it's related, I can't seem to put two and two together on this one, But the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act was one of the criticisms is that because we're trying to go after the Saudis for collusion with 9/11, and the argument is that the other countries could create laws that would prosecute us for military actions in their countries. Is there a relationship between this law that we apparently have now and Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism and how we Americans might get sued or Canadians might get sued? That's kind of an odd, a ethereal question right now. I don't know if I'm even making any sense. So I'll leave it at that, and if you can respond.
I don't know how good an answer I can provide to that, because I think there are certainly legal questions to be answered with regard to this. I mean, I don't even think it should be criminal for somebody to, even if he was an adult doing what he was doing. I don't really see how that's criminal in a country where. In a country that's been invaded by a foreign aggressor, why going over there and helping the side that was ousted should even be criminal in the first place? So that part's a mystery to me. So I don't know if there's any real correlation between that and the and what you're talking about. It's an interesting question, but I don't know if I've got more, if I have a more if I have more than that to comment on it.
Okay, great, thanks. That's all.
Okay.
Okay, Ken, I'd like to ask a question or make a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
Okay. Craig, I also want to thank you for taking this up and making us aware of it and other people. And I just wondered if the reason why a lot of the Canadians don't support the giving the money to this guy is they don't really know the truth. I mean, I don't know how the Canadian media covered it, but I'm guessing that it probably wasn't totally honest or including all the facts. And so I wondered if just their lack of knowledge is why they don't support it.
Well, I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. I think our media did an intermittently decent job some of the time. There's a reporter for the Toronto Star named Michelle Shepherd, who ended up writing a book called Guantanamo's Child, which I have not read, but I would like to. And there's also a documentary film under that same title that came out in 2015. So I think she's covered it very closely. So there has been some decent, because the media has tended to be actually more on Cotter's side, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Of course, being the mainstream media, they stop short of exposing the hypocrisy of the war on terror, in its totality. They just look at it in terms of, well, here's a legal, legal rights being ignored. So, but what strikes me, and I meant to say this before, but it's really what I got out of this is that so many people that are opposed, you're right, they don't know enough about it. All they know is terrorist, convicted terrorist, or whatever, and they haven't looked beyond that. But also, it's just people who have been brainwashed by the propaganda that's been thrown at us ever since 2001 and beyond. So, it's people who have bought into the whole war on terror thing, that when they see something like this and they just think, well, there's these Muslim terrorists all over the place, and so here's another one, and okay, so he was a little bit too young, but still, what's he doing over there? My son wouldn't have been over there, so why should we worry about him, People, I've seen that comment, I've said, well, he was brought over there, by his family, and it's not his fault, and anyway, there was a lot, an enormous amount of ignorance. And kind of, to me, it was kind of not just ignorance, but mean-spirited ignorance, when somebody's basically brushing off the idea of rights. I think, well, what is it you stand for? You're all pro-Western and pro-democracy and all that, and yet when it comes to actual supposed Western democratic values, like rights, people just kind of, they're happy to brush those off, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Well, thank you. I appreciate your doing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Work, yeah.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of the queue. So, Craig, thanks for a very illuminating presentation, one that we certainly deserve to pay attention to. Now it's time for announcements. Does anybody have any announcements? Well,
this is Wayne.
Wait a minute. I've got to take it off of question and answer mode here so everybody has an opportunity to jump in. Okay, so does anybody have any announcements?
Yep. Well, this is Wayne.
Yeah.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, just this is kind of pretty much in general. Just before our next conference call, we're going to have the 72nd anniversary of the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And here in Connecticut, we're going to be having an event, as we have for many decades, as I understand it, remembering that and working against nuclear weapons. And I hope everyone else on the call will take an opportunity to try to keep our fearless leaders' fingers off the nuclear triggers. Over.
Okay. Any other announcements?
It's Mike Cook.
Michael, go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, thanks. Amen to that, Wayne. Especially, you know, always the big fear about nuclear weapons has been we'll have crazy people in power, and by God, we've been there for a long time. I'm going to be getting on an airplane for the first time since 9/11. I'm going to fly to Vegas for training in insulating power plants, industrial insulation at my union's national headquarters in Vegas for a week. So fingers crossed the plane doesn't blow up and all that.
Yeah. Okay. Any other announcements?
This is Jane Clark. Can you hear me?
Yes, Jane. Go ahead.
Mick Harrison's going to be on a call on a show tomorrow, a radio show, and I don't have the information, but it's going to be tomorrow night. I think it's 7 Central Daylight Time. And I could get that to you if you could send it out to everyone, but I don't know where I put
the
information on.
I don't know about sending it out to everyone, but if you send it to me, I'll put it out on our discussion listserv, which, by the way, anybody who's not on our discussion listserv is welcome to join. Okay, just send me your request, and we'll get you on it if you're on this call. But the more active members are on the discussion listserv, so they'll all get that information, okay?
Okay, I'll get it to you. And could I say one more thing, Kim?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A friend of mine, that she's a female Jewish lawyer here in Dallas, and I, we're going to go down to Guantanamo to try to represent some of the people down there because habeas corpus was totally abolished when Bush put all those people in there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What we found was it was too cost prohibitive to do because you had to pay for your own trip, which wasn't a problem, pay for a translator that the military provided to you, which could be up to $4,000 to $6,000 a day, and pay for
Wait a minute, Jane. Why does the military provide it to you? Why can't you provide your own translator?
Clear. You can't do that. They were the only ones allowed to provide the translator, and the cost had to be borne by the attorney themselves personally. So it got very difficult for any lawyers to try to help those people down there. And whoever they ended up was probably a military defense lawyer assigned by the government. There was a group in New York that did get some lawyers together, but it was cost prohibitive. We couldn't afford to do it. We were going to do it.
So that
this was a female Jewish lawyer that was going down to help Muslims. She said, this is not right what they're doing. And we were both going to. We couldn't afford it.
Well,
and they kept,
it's
everything to everybody.
It seems to me, Gene, that the business about it having to be a military translator is unconstitutional. Okay, I don't see how they can make that stipulation. It seems to me that that's something that should be up to the client.
Nope. They say we are the one that are going to have the trial. You have to go through our screening thinking process, and here's
what
the
a joke. What a joke. God,
so
that's pathetic. Are you still trying to do this? Are you still interested in trying to do this, Jane?
No, not at this point. We you would go down there, and sometimes we heard from the other attorneys, you go down there, sometimes you would be able to see them after the trip you made, arranging to pay for the translator. Sometimes you didn't. The discovery was not allowed. You couldn't get any documents on even what the charges were at the time.
Yeah.
Didn't even know what the charges were at the time.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It was really, really bad. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
That's all I have, and I'll send you Max Nick's information.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Okay. Any other announcements?
Yeah, Craig, a quick one. A friend of mine was actually flying out from Montreal to the U.S., an American friend, and I had sort of half-jokingly said, we were discussing the whole thing about the TSA and how they do things, and I was commenting on the fact that I wondered how long it would be before we ended up following suit in Canada. And then when my friend went in through the screening process to get on the flight, I got a text saying that, in fact, Canada has now just as of very recently, a week or so, now has body scanners, the same that you have in the U.S. So I just thought I would throw that out there. It just means that we've just gotten sucked in, to following
bad.
That path. So I don't know if we have the full body pat downs or not, but.
And I'd like to make an announcement for the benefit of the call. On our next call, Wayne is going to be presenting on the exit hole on the Pentagon. And we've been looking forward to an opportunity to experiment with our online meeting, which will give callers an opportunity to not only be on the audio call, but also to be connected on the internet to slide presentation that will be made at the same time. So Wayne and I, and hopefully some other volunteers, will be working to develop this option so that when he makes his presentation, anybody on the call who wants to connect online will be able to watch the slides as they are being presented, and that will add to the immediacy of the presentation, and then that will create a template for future presentations. So that information will be provided, assuming we get it right and can straighten it out, on the next draft agenda for August. So be prepared to not only call in, but also join the online meeting so that you can watch the slides as they are being presented and Wayne makes his presentation next month. Okay? Any other announcements?
Okay. I have a question.
Well, yes.
Question?
Go ahead.
I just responded to the email that I got for this call. Is that going to you, Ken?
Probably.
Okay. It's address DIOGEN.
That's me. That's me.
Okay. Good. Okay. Yeah. I requested to be added to the listserv, and just so everybody knows, I work a tremendous amount of hours 7 days a week, 12 hours a shift quite often. We're scheduled for 10 months of that next year. It's going to be major money, but it's
well,
very
we'll
hard
you on the
to do
list
anything else.
We'll get you on we'll add you
thank
to the listserv. No problem, Michael. Thank you.
Thank okay. you. Thank you.
And anybody else that would like to be on the listserv, if you're on this call, you're welcome to join our listserv discussion, which continues our conversations in between calls. So any other announcements before we close? Okay, hearing none, then I guess that's it until August. So we'll see you the last Wednesday in August, and have a good month, and keep fighting, okay?
All right. Y'all take care.
Bye,
hey.
Everyone, yeah.
Good night.
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 Just the three of us. Let me turn off the recording.
Yeah.